Hello, people, and welcome back to the Out of Bounds podcast. We are back after another week of sports where a lot of things happened. Arsenal fans went into meltdown. We had Usyk versus Dubois, and Formula One is back. So with that being said, we are back with the cast. Me, Richard, we've got Sam, we've got Abbas. How are we doing?
I'm all good, bro. Man. I'm all good. How are you? How's your bank holiday weekend in it?
It was crap.
Listen, last week I go, I can only get a trim if Chelsea get a win. I was able to get the trim.
Oh yeah,
look at the low vibration. Win against Luton, you know. That's your expectation.
I just said I need to get a trim. Ooh. I spoke to the cafe. He said, "Yeah, don't worry, I got you."
Yeah, and then I went. It's performance.
But that's a cool thing.
All right, cool. Let's see. If you get a win in the next two weeks, then you can get a trim in it. I doubt it, but let's see.
No, I'm getting a trim in the next 2 weeks. Don't get me wrong. International football.
Without the win, yeah? Without the win streak continuing.
You got to remember, it's international football. I can't last 3.5 weeks.
Oh, yeah. Now. There you go. You're right. So you got to blight.
Yeah. But as I said, Chelsea, we finally got a win against Luton. Sterling, I mean, he's been playing good first two games, but I mean, that was a great performance against Luton. Enzo as well. I was saying he might be the best pass in the league. He could be the best pass in the league. But, you know, that's not what we're here for, because on the other side of London, I know it's really the other side, but like Northwest, quite a big distance. Arsenal fans seem to be in meltdown. And I made a TikTok about how I feel like Arteta's doing too much. Like, he thinks he's Pep. And unfortunately, not everybody can be Pep. Pep is who he is for a reason. I'm not sure I might slander him. Arteta, you need to earn your stripes. So he's gone with a thing where he's not doing Partey to do the right back thing and then invert, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Because he's trying to get Odegaard, Havertz, Rice and Partey all in the same team. And to me, it just feels like Arsenal have lost their identity a bit. Like, because even when you look at the first two games of the season they won, I think they beat Crystal Palace, which they won by a pen. And I can't remember who they played in the first game because I didn't watch the game. But none of the performances have been convincing. And I've heard a lot of people call out for Havertz to be dropped. Just before we talk about Arsenal in general, what do you guys think of Havertz at Arsenal so far?
Do you know what? I'll quickly tell you this one. As an overall player, I like Havertz, isn't it? Like, I liked him when he was at Bayer Leverkusen. And obviously, being a City fan, him going to Chelsea, I wasn't happy with that. But I'm one of the guys, regardless if you go to my team, if you're a player I like, I'm still going to support you. But then one issue he had there is that going to Chelsea at that time, Chelsea is going through a transition, manager after manager. And this is what sometimes happens to players when they're too good for their own sake. Because Kai Havertz was good, yeah, and you saw what he was doing in Germany, that he was able to kind of fit in different positions. You see him play as a false nine, out wide, as a 10, and he was never able to kind of hone his position in it. But when Arsenal bought him, based on how Arteta wants to play, similar to Pep, I thought, you know what, Havertz would be a good addition to how Arsenal play with, you know, they could have the build up with the three at the back, two midfield, and then five attackers with the 2-3-8. So I thought Havertz playing as a 3-8, he'll excel. But I'm not gonna lie, the first three games it hasn't been great. And not because he's not good. I just think he's still just suffering from confidence, isn't it? He hasn't got the confidence to kind of flourish and develop his game. And this is where Arteta has to kind of earn his stripes, whether that's more coaching, you know, on and off the field, or you have to do something that you might not want to do, is have a £70 million player burn in your back pocket and sit him on a bench and just ease him into the team. Because as Rich was saying, it does seem that he's trying to tinker. And he's making all these changes to try and accommodate Kai Havertz. I know it's only three games, so we can't be too reactionary. But he has to find a solution, because we see it's not working. And in terms of him trying to be like Pep, we see it because he's got Partey playing at the right back. But then now he's playing with basically three centre-backs, because he's got Kvyat, or however you pronounce his name, playing left back. When you've got Kieran Tierney, but for some reason he don't want to use Kieran Tierney. Now he's gone alone to Real Sociedad. Zinchenko, we don't know if he's fully fit or if he's not, but he's still coming on to play games. So we just don't know what, you know, Arteta and Arsenal are trying to do. But just to answer your question in short, I don't think it's been a great start for Kai Havertz. Hopefully he can improve, but the fans and the pundits, as we can see, are not having it right about now.
Do you know what it is with Kai? So, like, I'll say it as well. If I like a player, I'm going to still stick with the player. I can banter it a bit more because he's on the opposite side now. But at the end of the day, like, Kai Havertz, whilst he was there at Chelsea, probably stepped up in the biggest of moments for Chelsea. So he wasn't ever prolific in terms of goal scoring and stuff. But again, we didn't. Nobody still knows Kai Havertz's position. Mm. And if you look at it, he's coming to Arsenal and they want to play him in midfield. Fine. That's not going to work for Kai Havertz unless you're able to accommodate that. If you're playing more forward, then you've got Gabriel Jesus and Nketiah to deal with in that side. He can't play out wide. And basically out wide, you've got Saka and Martinelli anyway. So you've got them locked in that position or Trossard. So if you're putting him in that midfield, whatever he can't do from a defensive side, you're going to have to find ways to accommodate. And that's probably why he's trying Partey out there. For me, the surprise thing about this whole thing is you've got centre-backs that are injured, but Gabriel's still not playing. And I don't know how he goes from a guy that was basically featured all throughout the entire season to now not even getting a spot in the defence when you've got multiple injuries in the defence.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. Like, obviously, I was a big defender of Havertz last season, or even just with his time in general. I feel like a lot of the criticism that came with Havertz to do, because he was playing the strike position and he can't finish, I feel like that allowed people, that clouded people's judgment of what Kai Havertz is. And I've said it before, I do think talent-wise, I do feel like Havertz is really good, but I do feel like he's also one-dimensional in the kind of way he does play. I feel like you need to play him either like a false nine or number 10. Because with Havertz, I feel like the further you keep him away from the goal, the least effective that he be. And everyone talks about he's not like a long range passer, but I feel like if you were to allow him to do passes around the edge of the box, you know, the final pass kind of thing when you're in the final third, I feel like that's what it's good for. But then if you expect him to pick up the ball from deep, drive it and all that kind of stuff, and then start beating 3-4, like what Martin Odegaard does, I feel like that's where you go wrong. Plus, I also feel like the change of system as well doesn't really suit him as well, because with Declan Rice playing number 6 and Partey going at right back, I've said it time and time again, Declan Rice is going to have to play regardless because it costs 100 million. But what Partey can do as a 6 or what Declan Rice can do as a 6, I feel like Partey clears him in terms of getting the ball from the defence and progressing the ball and all sorts as a passer and stuff like that. But because Declan Rice is there, I feel like Havertz has to then do more and stuff. And also, it's also one of those things that since he came into Arsenal, he's never really had the full support of the fans that he did. Like when he first, I remember when we were going in for him and everyone was like, announce Kai, announce Kai, announce Kai. This time it's like, why are we buying Havertz? Why are we buying Havertz? Why are we buying Havertz? And people are now calling for Smith Rowe to start ahead of him, Vieira to start ahead of him, Reece Nelson, or put Rice in the number 8. And as I said, it's one of those things that bold decisions are going to have to be made. You can't have everybody in the lineup. As I'm not going to say Gabriel is elite, but you're going to have to move back to put in Ben White right back. You have your 2 centre back, and then at worst, have Shevchenko play that guy, and he'd be the one to vote because he's really good at doing that. So, as I said, the slow start, as long as everyone is good to scapegoat Havertz, I feel like the bigger problem is Arteta trying to, and obviously I understand you don't want to do the same thing because you might get found out and stuff, but at the same time, you're not Pep. You know what kind of players you have and you know what works.
Do you know what's funny? Like you said, meltdown for this week. Next week or the coming week when we're recording this, like when they play United and United's injuries, ooh, if they don't win that game just before the international break, that's a meltdown. That's when you are going to hear stuff.
Yeah. But that's the thing though. With Arsenal fans, they're very reactionary and very fickle because, like Richard was saying, these are the same guys that are saying, oh, because Fabio Vieira had a little 25-minute cameo, now he's that guy starting. But when they were playing Brentford a cup last season and they were struggling, they were saying, why is this guy starting? Take him off, he needs to go on loan. So I don't really take too much heed in what the Arsenal fans say, or just fans in general, because fans are very fickle. And we, like, with me, I keep it 100. With everyone I like, I keep the same energy. Same thing we saw with Darwin Nunez. When he's thinking up the place, oh, this guy's not a £70 million striker. Oh, not good. He's not this. I always liked him from when he was at Almeria and Benfica. But then he has 2 prime finishes. Now they're saying, oh, Nunes, elite striker, proper number nine. If he was consistent, he's better than Haaland. But like, what they want from Nunes is that they want him to do more stuff and contribute to games and have a better first touch. But then this is the same thing, and they want him to score goals, for example. But then this is the same argument they use against Haaland and say, oh, Haaland just score goals. He doesn't contribute to the game. So what do you want from your striker? Do you want him to be a guy that's going to score goals and just get tap-ins and not contribute? Or are you looking for R9 or Benzema? Like, make it make sense, innit? So with fans, you just got to just live by what they say, because they go week to week and they kind of change. With me, I keep it 100. Like I said, if I mess with you, then I might say you're smelly this week, but I'm still going to say you're my guy. I'm not going to throw you under the bus.
Yeah. All right. So speaking on to, I know to call them Arsenal rivals, because it's not really a rival. It's kind of like one-way streak, as Man City did win the treble. But it's to do with Rodri, because I can't remember the last time I've watched City and I felt like Rodri had a bad performance. His consistency over like the past year and a bit has been outstanding. And he's now raised questions, because obviously he came in clutch for Man City after they went that 1-0 down to, or went 1-1 to Sheffield United. Given the Sheffield United, as I said, he came in clutch in the Champions League final. The goal he scored against Bayern. And these are just European performances. He's done a clutch against Arsenal as well. And normally I come and I've always said, to me, KDB is the best player in the league. But if someone is consistently playing at a higher level than Rodri is, given, even though he's a DM, do you feel like he deserves shouts for one being the best player in the Premier League? Or
One quick thing, Rich, and then Abbas can go. Like you were saying in terms of Rodri,
you see, I knew when you were bringing up as well. So I was like,
you see man's performance. Look at that. Just greens like, all the green, time.
Green.
All the time. Then like three or four men of the matches. And he's becoming Mr. Clutch, man. So I think we got a rating, but I'll let Abbas go first and I'll add my 2 cents after.
So this is what you were going to say. I did a video literally yesterday and I said, Man City have champions DNA. And what I mean by that is, when one guy goes down, next man steps up. Gundogan goes out. Okay, we got KDB still. KDB goes out. Rodri, you're in. It's a case of, okay, you may not play that same position, that particular role, but you inherently are champions DNA. And that's what Rodri is. He has that champions DNA in him. And he knows that, okay, if I need to come clutch, whether it's from a goal scoring standpoint, assisting, or just putting through an overall masterclass, I'm going to do it. The thing what I will say is, and this is just because if you take the goals away, people will still talk about him. I'll say this because he plays for Man City. The same way people are highlighting Kovacic. Kovacic was doing the exact same stuff as he was doing at Chelsea. The only difference is it's at Man City, so it's a bit more pleasing to see on the eye. But yeah, no, Rodri is up there, top three player in the league. Like I said, in terms of midfielders, I'm still going to probably take Kevin De Bruyne and Martin Odegaard over him, because one, they're probably a bit more forward thinking, and I think they can probably control the tempo of a game more. But yeah, Rodri is in there. But I think for Man City overall, in that midfield, to play there, you've got to have what I call champions DNA. Gundo's out, no problem at all. He can step up, do the job. And you saw it, I think for me, he scored the biggest goal outside of Aguero, and that was in the Champions League final.
Come on.
He's got champions DNA. That's the best way I describe Rodri at this moment in time. Like, he knows what to do. Even when they went 1-1, it was a case of, okay, cool, 1-1, no problem. Foden, bang, straight on the attack. It didn't even look like Sheffield were going to rest. And then it was like inevitable that he was going to step up and do something. And yeah, like, champions DNA for Rodri. Can't say anything more than that.
And you know what? With Rodri, in terms of optics, you might not look at him as being the most stylish or most glamorous player. But if you actually look at it based on the team on paper, him being a controller, he's actually Man City's most important player. Because if you take him out of that team and put Calvin Phillips in, now you're a different team in terms of how you're dictating the games and how you're playing. And I think people kind of underestimate how important Rodri is, because even when he first came, and also you got to credit Pep as well in terms of coaching. Remember, Pep played that position and he played it to a T as well. And in the first season, when I used to watch City games, Rodri used to get on my nerves because he didn't know how to play that DM role properly. He would get forward too many times. He would lose his man. Whereas now, he kind of plans when he needs to come forward, and more time, he's just standing, he's just staying back, controlling, being the extra defender that's needed if he needs to, but then also he's the one that he gets the ball, looks up, knows, yes, I'm technical enough to be on the ball, but you know what? I'm going to get the ball to the better players, whether that's a De Bruyne, whether that's a Bernardo Silva, whether that's a Foden, whether that's a Mahrez when he was still there, or Grealish. And I just think he just read the game and he's dominating. And I saw a tweet, which is so true and funny. Obviously, City, we've got great players, yeah? But somebody said, when Modric won the Ballon d'Or, yeah, if you look at what Rodri's done in the last year to 18 months, based on his stats and what he's achieved and how he's important to that team, then you've got a case to say that, you know, Rodri could be in there to win the Ballon d'Or. I know he won't because it's not the glamorous. He's not the glamorous option and he doesn't play for Real Madrid or Barcelona to win it as a DM. But if you just look at optics and stats-wise, you're like, it is comparable that Rodri's probably had a better season than what Modric had when he won the Champions League. Won the Ballon d'Or. Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay, obviously, just before we move on to the next topic, just quickly. So, as I said, I saw on TalkSport earlier today, people were comparing Rodri to Prime Kante. You think Rodri has done enough to say he's better than Prime Kante, or do you still feel like what Prime Kante did is undeniably great?
I'm not being ignorant here. What was Prime Kante? That, just so you can break it down to me, what was Prime Kante? I'm just trying to figure that out.
The season where they won the Premier League with Leicester, up until when Chelsea won the Champions League.
Yeah, I'd say that period. The only thing is, this is what I'll say, and this is where people get the image side of things. If you look at him, Kante is not a 14-year-old little boy. The way people perceive this guy and his image, like, Kante's smiling, let's keep him smiling. Oh, he is that. Don't treat me like I'm just some 14-year-old kid or something like that, like I've done something amazing. I'm a professional. And I think a lot of people run with that, like, oh, Kante, look, he's smiling. How can you not be happy with Kante smiling type of thing? But what I'll say is, like, for me, it's like Busquets, for example. Busquets was never actually appreciated until Busquets wasn't playing. And even now, if you look at MLS, like, he's still playing very well.
Oh, MLS, he's playing in slow mode. I always knew because that guy, Busquets, was a controller. So going to MLS was really slow. He's like 10 steps ahead of them.
Like, I'll say this, Rodri's probably more appreciated whilst he's playing at a more of a higher level than I think probably Busquets was until it got a bit later on. So I'd say this, like, Kante's probably got more of the fans' vote. And I'd probably still stick with Kante right now just because it's been a bit longer. But yeah, no, Rodri's up there as well.
It's a tough one because they're two different players. But yeah, if you look at what Rodri's achieved and, like, the big moments, he's going to have moments where you talk about, oh, the Rodri moment. So that's something that you're going to have to add to it, where Kante is, like, you see it, but it's not there. It's not on the stats line. It's not on a stat sheet where, okay, cool, he stepped up big. So it's a bit different. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to be biased. I'm going to say Rodri because that's my guy.
The only thing I'll say is Kante has an award that Rodri hasn't got yet. And that's that he's got the PFA player of the season.
Yeah, but that was because everything was just a one-off. It was all crazy.
For Rodri, if he's going to, like I said, like, I like Rodri, but if he's going to have a dominant full season rather than, like I said, Rodri moments, and you don't see Kante on the stats, but you appreciate Kante over a season. If he wins that award, bearing in mind the position he's playing versus the forwards that are going to score goals and assists and stuff like that, then yeah, you can do for now. That's probably wild edge.
But then what you said, then it kind of discredits why he won it, because everyone looks at Kante as, oh, he's a smiling,
he's
a lovable African guy that you can like. You don't need to be afraid of him. Like, that's the narrative they're told. So
and you just want to hug him.
Mahrez could have easily won it that year as well, or Vardy could have won it. But you went with guy that...
Yeah, Kante won it. Mahrez did win it in Leicester. Kante won it in Chelsea's one.
Oh, in Chelsea's?
He won it with Chelsea, won it. So that's what I mean.
Won it that year, but that's beside the point. I think to still be in contention is still... incredible. But as I said, there were just so many Kante performances that you just felt like he's done it again and he's done it again and he's done it again. So obviously, I don't think, even though he played higher up the pitch, he didn't probably have as much clutch goal moments, but I feel like he had a lot of clutch defensive moments. So the amount of times he stopped a counter attack from happening, last ditch tackles, always able to run. And on the counter attack, I feel like Kante was very, very underrated at starting counter attack. So I don't know. As I said, it is very, very tough. But as I said, like, Kante still gets put into conversation that Rodri's name hasn't even been there yet. So I don't know, we'll see. But if Rodri can continue like this, I feel like now he's starting to get the recognition he deserves. So we're going to see where he is at the end of the
season. Like I said, I think the switching point will be if he wins that PFA award.
Cool. So if we're doing like this year, so Kante now, he's playing in Saudi, yeah? So what was Kante's run? What, 3 years? Or what, 4 years? What was his run?
No, so...
2016. We start when they won 2016. Cool. When they won.
Start from 2015 because it's 15-16. So 15 up until 21. Okay, cool. So 6 years.
For 20 till 21.
Yeah.
You said he was in his prime till 2021.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's a prime member of a squad.
But no, but when you say prime, it's like you say LeBron in his prime. You're gonna say when he was. You're not gonna say Lakers years now. You're gonna say okay, it was from 2010 or. Whatever.
Yeah, so I'll say 2015 to 21.
Yeah, I can save solid six. I can do that because okay. In between there he was still the starting in France's yeah. World Cup teams.
I think his last two seasons at Chelsea.
Once the injuries kicked in after that, then fair.
Yeah, his last two seasons at Chelsea was just fucked by injuries so many times that I couldn't even give him.
But basically, Rodri needs to keep this up for 2 to 3 years, and then he's in the same.
I think he can be there before. For me, what separates him right now is obviously you could say potentially the longer side of it, but then Rodri's won the team accomplishment. I think as an individual, if he can get that award, which is probably just going to be like a little stamp on to say, bang, like, look.
But then that's a bit difficult because... No, wait,
plus as well, but before you go, just plus as well, remember, KDB's out this year. So yeah. There is now someone
yeah,
else.
But you know how football is. They're going to go by goals and assists and it's always going to be Haaland. Another thing I just want to just kind of clarify, because obviously you guys are Chelsea fans. That year when he won, who was in your team attacking-wise? Because... And
Costa, Pedro and Hazard.
Pardon?
Costa, Pedro, Hazard were the front three.
Costa was top goal scorer, I think, as well that year.
Yeah, but Costa was not a fan favorite. You know, he's never going to win it. He's basically like.
I think Hazard should have won it that year. To be fair, I feel like
I'm just asking because I'm saying in terms of winning that type of personal accolade in a team like Man City, it's going to be very difficult for a DM to win because you're going to have great players ahead.
He doesn't have to win it.
You say that. But Ruben Diaz came and won in 6 months.
Yeah, but you got to realize, you know football, yeah? Football's never about a DM. It's always about your defenders.
No, but I'm saying,
when it comes to awards, yeah, it's always your defenders, yeah? Or your attacking midfielders or strikers. A DM's never going to look like... A DM's not a glamorous position because essentially you're a guy that's not technically enough to play further up the pitch.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Don't get me wrong. I understand what you mean. Defender. I just think that it's not... out of the realms now because of how we talk about Rodri. I feel like Rodri's highlighted. He's not just, okay, cool, Rodri is Rodri. Like, he's highlighted as probably one of the three key players now when they talk about Man City.
100%. But yeah, that's just my theory and just thought process in terms of, again, how these awards are. They're very glamour. There's obviously certain type of narratives behind it. Every award there's a narrative unless it's clear cut.
I think Rodri's a bit glamorous now anyway in terms of like him being the player. Pause, by the way. But you know what glamorous. I mean? Like him being the player, people are like,
glamorous. And until this season, certain fans were saying it was Partey, Cass and then Rodri.
That's
what I was hearing, which I knew that wasn't the case. But again, that's my whole point in terms of not the glamour name and how they say, oh, City fans.
I don't think he's got the glamour name like Casemiro, but like the Casemiro and Varane, they're getting their pension, they're getting the state pension for football.
Now, I don't agree with that because even Zinchenko, again, I saw it with Vibe with Five and they was asking who's the better DM, Partey or Rodri. He said Partey. Obviously, he's going to say that because he's his teammate.
Listen, I'll be honest, don't get me started with Vibe with Vibe. Rio Ferdinand saying prime Benzema, but he was retired.
I saw. Yeah, I said he was playing.
Suarez, bro. It's all right.
I know what you say. I get what you're saying, but he maybe used it wrong, the wrong term. But I know what you're saying as well, Bas.
Benzema is the worst one out of all three of them. But I said Benzema is the worst one out of all three of them.
Who?
Suarez, Lewandowski, and Benzema.
Don't do that.
We'll have that conversation a different day because we're going to switch over. But I think Lewandowski's career is better than his. But
in playing in the German league, say no more. In the German league, yeah. It doesn't matter because when I'm watching Harry Kane, I'm seeing the defending is smelly. Like I see
all the defenders
moving to the fullback, and then Alfonso David just cross it in and there's a tap.
That's why you can't say that.
I'm going to say this to back Lewandowski's case, right? And this is because, like, if you take the league side of things, right? What Lewandowski's done with his international team to get Poland into all these tournaments is a madness. Because I can't lie. If you look at Norway right now, I would say Norway are still more talented than any team Lewandowski had for Poland, right? And I still think, even if Haaland was to play all through the qualifier, I think they still struggle to make it through. Like, right now, these Euros and the next World Cup, they should be making them tournaments, but I think they'll struggle to make the Euros. And then the World Cup is a different conversation. That's when I started growing more of an appreciation for Lewandowski, when I deeped and realized, in Poland, bro, he was playing with scrubs. And he was still, every tournament, making it through.
Qualifying for international tournament, playing in Europe is not hard. Like, you're playing against Liechtenstein.
But what I'm saying is, three things is, one, yeah, Lewandowski was part of that Dortmund team that won the league before Bayern started the dominance. So I don't think Lewandowski is a pro of being at Bayern. I feel like Bayern continued the dominance because of Lewandowski, because he is the second highest goal scorer in Bundesliga history, which he would have broken if he stayed there. Number two, he was still able to get that Dortmund team to a Champions League final, which they lost to one of the most dominant teams of all time in Bayern 2012 and 13. Yeah?
And Lewandowski
just won a Liga last season as well. So it's not a thing of he's playing in Germany. I feel like anyway, Lewandowski would have done this as well.
Don't take it in a bad way that I don't like Lewandowski. I love Lewandowski. I like all three of them. Like, but I do think overall, like, people look at Benzema because he's a selfless player. He decided, okay, cool, I'm not going to reach or have the pinnacle career that I should have because I'm gonna say, you know, I'm going to step aside, let Ronaldo do his stuff and help the team achieve what they need to achieve.
But that may be true, but then...
That's what he did. And he's in those seasons, he was still stepping up and still had big, memorable moments. And then
100%, but I can't do hypothesis and say, oh, but what would Benzema's career be like if he didn't have...
I'm not saying that. We saw them win the Champions League three times in a row. He's won five Champions League.
Yeah, exactly. And he deserves huge credit for that.
It's not hypothetical.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying. But then I'm also saying, what Lewandowski also did. Didn't Van Bayern go a year when they won all six trophies as well? Just some stuff that are undeniably great. And as I said, I feel like
he was there. That was with Hansi Flick.
And people like to say he plays in Germany, and also try to say, oh, because of he doesn't step up in the big games and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, I think he's just behind Benzema, but he's also top five in Champions League all scorers of all time. So I'm not going to disrespect Benzema and say Lewandowski clears him, but I feel like...
But Suarez clears him.
Suarez is clear number one. Like, there's no conversation there. But I'm just saying, in terms of Lewandowski, a lot of what Lewandowski and Bayern achieved, it was all done as Lewandowski as their best player. There were times when Benzema, like, Modric was better than him, Tony was better than him, Ronaldo was better than him, Gareth Bale was better than him.
Richard, you're funny there. You said Lewandowski their best player. I think it wasn't. It was a whole collective because every single Bayern team's always been stacked. There's never been a team where it hasn't been stacked. When Pep was there, it was stacked. When Hansi Flick there, it was stacked. So I don't think it's just Lewandowski because we've seen Lewandowski come out, they play Müller, and it's still the same thing when Müller plays up front. So... it's not like he was in a smelly team. Like, Bayern have had players on players on players.
And they all have. So, I don't know. It's interesting. It might have to be when we do a whole video where we all dissect all three of their careers and see who would be the...
Whenever. I'm down.
Second. Yeah, 100%. Obviously, it won't be on the pod because we have to discuss other sports. So, it'll be a separate video just for, like, all the great strikes of a generation. But moving on to Saturday, we had a heavyweight clash for the title. Tyson Fury, you're watching because Usyk is actually fighting actual boxers. But he fought Daniel Dubois, and it wasn't the cleanest performance I've seen from Usyk, but it was still dominant regardless. And I think there was this huge controversy because of in the fifth round. Obviously, Daniel got the shot off, and now everyone's talking about is it a low blow? Is it a low blow or is it on the bell and all that kind of stuff? And obviously, I'm just going to quickly go for it. I think it was a low blow anyways. But I think the dynamics have been a bit interesting because I feel like not a lot of people... Now, obviously, I thought Usyk was very respected within the UK, but I've come to realize that a lot of UK, which I probably understand because Dubois is a British fighter, kind of wanted Usyk to lose. So a lot of them are now saying it was on the bell, it wasn't a low blow. And a lot of the people that were saying it's not a low blow are people that are either match room guys or have an agenda against... what's his name? Frank Warren, isn't it? I know that kind of stuff. I think it's a low blow anyways, but there's two questions I want to ask regarding the fight, and we're going to start with the low blow. Do you guys actually, because especially Abbas, I know you watch more boxing, do you think that was a low blow or do you feel like it was on the money?
So, do you know what? Like, because of where the belt line was, I can't say, for me, like, when I saw it, that the first thing, I was like, oh, he got him with a good body shot, like, just at the start, even though the angle was a bit weird. And then they said it was low, and I just looked and I thought that doesn't seem low to me. I get why people are saying it can potentially be low, but for me, like, because of where he caught him, I don't care where your shorts were, because he got you on the belt line. For me, it wasn't below. It was good enough for me to say that was a clean shot. The one thing I'm just going to say is Usyk's got previous with this. Like, he's done it against Joshua. So this is the one thing I'll say, like, Usyk does have previous where he might get hit, and because of Usyk's character and what we just think of him as the honest fighter and all this thing, which he probably is, I'm not going to shit on his character like that, but because of what the perceived feeling is about Usyk, we just go with, yeah, he's probably right, and then we'll go down. But yeah, I didn't think it was a low blow. I'm not going to turn around and say the other thing, though, that Daniel Dubois was robbed, because the only way it's a robbery is if it's as clear-cut as it's ever been. And last robbery I remember was probably Cattrall and Taylor. So it wasn't a robbery. He was just very unlucky. But if you realistically expect that Daniel Dubois is going to get any sort of favourable decision in Poland, where you're basically set up at this point to, you have to knock him out clean to get an opportunity to win this fight, then you're crazy. You don't get a decision like that. You don't beat Canelo on points as well. The same way you don't beat Floyd on points if it's a close fight in America. That's the only thing I'll say. Like, he had to be as clean as possible. It is controversial. I thought it was low, but I'm not saying it's a robbery like some people have been putting it out there.
So? With me, from watching boxing and know how boxing is, sometimes you got to play to, not even play, you got to make smart decisions. And when we've seen Usyk in terms of how he's boxing and how, even before the fights, he wears his belt below his below the navel, isn't it? So in boxing, anything below the navel is a low blow. Hence why you see some people, they wear their shorts up high and people look at them like, why are you wearing your shorts high? Because now you've set the ballpark in terms of where he can hit you. It's a different barometer. And when you do look it, it's borderline, but you can say it was a low blow because where his navel was and where the belt was, you shouldn't be punching there. So, and where the guard is as well, it's kind of a sticky kind of part because it's like, for example, goal line technology. You know, if it doesn't cross all over the line, it's not a goal. So it just depends on how the referee has kind of seen it and taken that particular punch. Regardless of that, Usyk was winning the fight anyway. It wasn't a robbery because Usyk, if the referee didn't do it as a low blow, Usyk would have got up. But people are moving like, oh, Usyk didn't get up, he would have been knocked out, the fight would have been stopped. It wouldn't have been like that. Obviously, Usyk did the move motion as it was a low blow, so he knows the ref's going to give him 5 minutes to recover. So people that are saying, oh, he would have knocked out Usyk, no, because Usyk would have got up. In this instance, he could have stayed on the ground and taken his time for 5 minutes. So long story short, for me, it did seem like a low blow. But again, when you're getting different kind of angles, they may look different, but for me, I'll say it's a low blow. Yeah. I'm not gonna.
And I agree with both of you in that point in terms of I didn't get the robbery because I believe I think even Usyk said it. And to be fair, we'll never know. Maybe the shot was that good that he wouldn't have gotten up. But at the end of the day, I think after the 4 minutes was done, because even the ref didn't even give him the full 5 minutes, he gave him 4 minutes. I can still see that Usyk was a bit shaken up from the shot, and I didn't see Dubois jump on him or so. And I think they were saying on TalkSport like a Deontay Wilder would go and go wild all swinging. But obviously, I want to talk about Dubois for a bit because now I've not followed this guy's career the way I follow like a Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua and stuff. But there's two fights that I've watched from Daniel Dubois, and this is coming from somebody that has never had a professional fight before. But I feel like between fighters, there's some kind of madness that they have to have to them. And I personally feel, although he was going to lose that fight regardless, there's some people that got on their shield. Like, you saw the way Errol Spence went out to Terence Crawford. I feel like Daniel Dubois quit. And now, obviously, I remember back in 2019, every single BT adult was about this new up-and-coming guy with Daniel Dubois and all that kind of stuff. Dynamite punch and blah, blah. And he had the fight against Joe Joyce. And obviously, he gave up. But I allowed it because obviously you can see his eye was swollen. So he took the knee, he stayed up for the 10 count, all that kind of stuff. But then this time his facial structure didn't seem to be in any real trouble. And he seemed to take a knee. And then obviously he gets up on the count of 10 and the ref calls it rightfully so. But I think what annoyed me even more was he came out to say he didn't quit. His team told him to, you know, stay down. Because obviously a lot of them stay until the count of 8 and they get up. But then you can't get to about number 10 and start saying, no, you want to continue the fight. So, obviously, he's still 25. He can still improve his skill set. But I believe in boxing, no matter how much skill you improve, the will to win is always, because there's going to be some times you go into deep waters and it's how you get out of it. And I feel like any time he feels like he's in a bit of pain, he just, from the two fights that I've watched closely anyways, I don't know if you guys know more about him, but do you guys feel like he quit or was there a thing where he felt like he was in serious trouble and he couldn't recover?
So, I don't think he... So, I'm not against it because, like you said, the first thing I'll say, this heavyweight division, similar to welterweight, and I said it in a video that I did, it's held up by one fight. So, because you're 25, you know these guys are in their 30s anyway. So, second, this undisputed fight happens, then the belts are going to just be scattered across all the...
Everywhere.
WBA, WBC, etc. Anyway, so essentially you live to fight another day. When it comes to Dubois here, in the back end of the... So it was the ninth round he got dropped. Was it the eighth or the ninth? I can't remember.
He got dropped in the eighth and then he finished in the ninth.
Okay, yeah. So if you remember, he got dropped in the back end of the eighth round. So you come out, you're already a little bit dazed. Like, we don't know how heavyweight punches are or whatever. You're a little bit dazed. You get dropped so early in the ninth. So you're looking at about 2 minutes to fight this guy, which you probably are a bit all over the place anyway. So, and you know you're behind on the cards. You know you've had a decision get against you. It's going to be the smart decision because you're Daniel Dubois and you know that you've put in a performance already against this guy that will probably have eyes on you. So even though you lose, it's not going to be a bad loss. And then, like I said, if they eventually do this undisputed fight, once that fight goes, the belts are going to be scattered. And a best belt will always be available for you to pick up, basically. So it's kind of one of them things where you live to fight another day because you know you aren't down on cards.
I don't think he's a quitter, but I was never a big fan of Daniel Dubois anyway. Like, Daniel Dubois, people kind of jumped on a bad wagon because, again, as Abbas knows, both of us, we love boxing and, like, combat sports. There's always sparring stories. And allegedly, he knocked down Anthony Joshua in sparring. So that was the rumor that kind of got everyone talking about him and who's this heavyweight and he can bang. Mm. And look, we saw the situation with Joe Joyce. But these are these guys that they were used to fighting bums, tomato cans, and they got gassed by that aura. And when you see Dubois, I don't think the hunger is there for him to, like, he's not bothered whether I win or lose.
It's the money. That money is
there, isn't it? And for me, I don't see him making any big steps. Like, with as much as, like, Joe Joyce, people look at him, they think he's young. Joe Joyce is a grown-ass man. He's like 39.
Yeah. Okay.
He's boxing gym is down the road from my house. But with Joe Joyce, you see the hunger. He wants to fight. He takes those risks. And one thing about Joe Joyce that people kind of don't like is that he's got no defense. He's always going about the iron chin. And sometimes that's going to stop. That's going to affect you at some point, especially in the heavyweight division where everyone can bang. So with Daniel Dubois, I won't say he's a quitter, but I still think there's no hunger to be like, okay, I've got knocked out. Like Abbas said, I'm going to use this as let me live to fight another day, which I don't think that's what he necessarily thinks. It's like, I don't want to go through this brutal slug again. Let me just take it out, and then keep it moving and, you know, get another fight. Go and fight another few guys on the UK scene or, you know, the gatekeepers in Europe and then come back and kind of rejuvenate myself. So I won't say he's a quitter. I'll just say he doesn't have the hunger, to be honest, where you can see there's fighters that have got the hunger. And like you said, boxing, they'll go out on their shield, innit, essentially.
Yeah. No, to be fair, I think that's the right word I'm looking for. I think hunger is the right... Because, I mean, at the end of the day, as Abbas said, he's 25. The belts get scattered. I mean, there's so many people that are fraudulent world champions at the end of the day. Because once the belts get scattered, they go and pick up one before they actually fight the top
champion.
You'll
be the regular WBA champion, the regular WBO
champion. And it's been funny because, I mean, I've just gone on Wikipedia quickly to look at Dubois fights since he lost to Joe Joyce. And it's like, who?
Exactly.
Like, obviously, as a casual boxing fan, like, I don't know if you guys know who Bogdan Dinu is, Joe.
Bro, what you need to watch, if you want to watch this, look at his Trevor fight. Bryan. Look at his fight before he fought Usyk. Don King's bingo hall fight. It was the funniest thing ever. That's how he got this fight. Because he was able to win there and he
became a somehow mandatory.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you need to I think the right word. Hunger is the right word because at the end of the day, there's some people that feel like you only get one chance at a championship and they fight their hearts out for it. And he doesn't strike me as that kind of person just yet. But I did, as I said, I didn't think he can become world champion, but he can be. I think he's one of those ones like, what's his name? Something Martin that Josh would be for his championship. Like, one of those like holder of the belts, but you're not actually one of the top people.
You're not respected. You're just the belt's on the warm seat for one more fight and you're going to lose it.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, I could be wrong because, as I said, I don't follow this guy's career. But as I said, every single BT advert back in the day was all about how you've got this next up-and-coming.
You're right. That was Frank Warren. Frank Warren going against Eddie Hearn and Andy Joshua saying, look, you've got your UK heavyweight champion over there. We're trying to build our one up there. Allegedly inspiring, he knocked out AJ didn't want none, and that was a story. And I don't, to be honest, I'm not a big fan of Frank Warren. I think he's very arrogant and ignorant as well. And he's very, everyone lies and contradicts themselves, but he's a walking contradiction in terms of what he says and the actions that he does. They don't represent his act, what he said. Like, he cussed Eddie Hearn for putting on like Jake Paul and all these fights. But it's the same guy that's going out there to say, okay, cool, Fury is going to go and fight Ngannou, and it's a fight. And then he's saying, when they ask him why he's not fighting real boxers, they're saying, well, Ngannou, we're not saying he's a big real boxer, but he can punch. But they're saying, why don't you go and fight Hrgović? Why don't you fight all these other guys? And then he has a cheat to come and say, well, these guys don't have a name. But you want to be a world champion, undisputed. Like, what do you mean they don't have a name? Just beat them and get the belts. Like, 1 minute Tyson Fury's fighting for charity or for the love of it, but now he's fighting for money. Make up your mind.
I know, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the heavyweight division after, because, I mean, at the end of the day, Tyson Fury's not losing the belt against Ngannou because the championship is not on the line, neither should it be, but it's one of those things where it's in, you feel like if you're the heavyweight champion of the world, you should be fighting, even if nobody knows who they are. It's your job to put on those kind of fights and promote it anyways. And you've got AJ, who's looking to pursue Wilder next anyways, and Usyk is going to wait for the unification. But on to the last thing, because obviously Formula One was back this, which, for some reason, the break didn't feel that long. I don't know why. Maybe it's because when Formula One, I totally switched off from Formula One when it went on the break, so maybe that's why it didn't feel as long.
Normally, the break 3 weeks, but for some reason, I think it was short. It was only 2 weeks this year.
I think there's more races in the calendar, probably. That's why.
That's probably why.
But yeah, so Verstappen has equal Vettel's record of 9 consecutive races in a row. Unfortunately, Perez, just go back to racing point or something, because he's actually starting to annoy. In fact, what Perez annoys me is not even that he is not a good driver because he's a race winner, blah, blah, blah. But it's the way he's allowed Max himself to get away with all these wins that really annoys me.
No, he's but, not even let you.
It's more so, it's again, like Dubois, it's more the mindset. Like, Perez is not a go-getter. Perez is, he races under adversity. Like, it's raining. Okay, you know, strategy. Let me put these tires on before everyone else. Let me come behind the field. He's not aggressive. Like,
Max, if you like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, if you want to beat Max, like Lewis said. What is Lewis? What was Lewis's famous quote we heard like 2 weeks ago? He goes, if I was in the same car as Max, Max would not be doing this to me.
Yeah.
Because Verstappen is basically Lewis Hamilton. Like, they're both aggressive drivers. They're going to take risks. They're going to do what they need to do. And if in Formula One, the way it's set up, you have your number one driver, your number two driver. But Perez is never going to have the heart and the mindset to challenge Verstappen the way everyone wants him to challenge him.
So, and you know, I think it's surprising as well. Now, so obviously, I'm not sure if the gap between Red Bull and the rest is as big as it was to begin the season. But I think what I do find quite fascinating is that, especially again with Lewis Hamilton as well, obviously when you've had the paddle talk, when everyone comes back and you have the Thursday talks, Lewis Hamilton was talking about how his goal for the rest of the season is to chase down Perez, which is quite interesting because, I mean, if not for Verstappen, or if we're just looking at Perez's performances, I would think the field is kind of close. I think it's Verstappen that makes you believe that Red Bull is far away from everyone else. But what I'm saying is, the fact that people are actually talking about chasing down Perez in the Red Bull makes me feel, what does his peers think about him? Because obviously, when he, obviously, Lance Stroll and Lawrence Stroll, you know those guys are never getting pressed out of a seat because he owned and all that kind of stuff. But when you look at the job that Perez did at Racing Point when he won that race, and everyone was talking about how, like, it's kind of weird how Perez doesn't have a seat going into the next year and stuff, even though he should have been there instead of Lance Stroll, but that's a conversation for a different day. I think he's a better driver than Lance Stroll. But then obviously he then gets an opportunity at Red Bull. I feel like there's some drivers that are just built to be mid-table drivers and stuff. And I feel like that's what he strikes me as. Now, obviously, Verstappen is generational talent, and there's no problem with him being up front. But I've always said, the way I always just look at it is, I always go back to the Hamilton and Rosberg days in terms of, like, even though Rosberg knew Hamilton was better, but he was determined to make sure he gets one. I feel like you just don't see that with Perez, which is unfortunate because nobody wants to see Max Verstappen win like 10 races in a row. I'm praying on his downfall every day.
It's never happening.
I don't see it happening this season. It would be an embarrassment. Like, if Verstappen was to win the rest of the races from now to the end of the season, there would be an internal crisis call that where they would have to figure out what we need to do regulation, because this won't be good for F1. Because if it's going to be like that, you know, going into next season, Max is going to dominate again and it's not going to look good. So I don't know what's going to happen. In terms of Perez, like you said, I think Perez is more suited to, you know, the middle pack teams, the AlphaTauri, I can't say Aston Martins now because they're actually better now, but McLarens, the guys where he doesn't have to win races, but he just has to accumulate points and look good and be the best of the rest. I think that's where you see Perez excelling. In terms of Red Bull, it's a bit scary because Verstappen has Red Bull at their necks, isn't it? Like, Red Bull's not going to make a move to make Max uncomfortable. So the second driver is never going to be that person that can challenge Max. So as a fan, don't be looking for the Red Bull driver to challenge Max. It has to be a driver from another team, i.e. Mercedes, Aston Martin, Ferrari, McLaren. Because he came out and said something about how
him and Lando Norris have talked about being teammates, but obviously Norris has a long contract with McLaren, so we're going to have to see what happens then. But
because Lando is the type of guy who would want
to race.
Yeah, he would want to compete, and that's just not going to happen. Red Bull don't want to risk it because what you go from a team that's basically dominating everything, especially the constructors, to two drivers who could potentially hit each other, knock each other out.
You go back to Weber days. You go back to when Weber's like, cool, I know I'm the number two, but I want to win races. And it's like, and that's when you start having those collisions and stuff like that, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, just a quick question before I go on to Mercedes. Because you said, obviously, if Verstappen goes on to win the rest of the race, there'll be a crisis within F1 or regulation, whatever. But do you feel like there's actually a big issue with the regulations? Because really and truly, if you take away Maxi's wins and points and stuff, and let's say the Formula One season was from Perez down, then this would look like an all-timer season with the amount of different race winners you would have had and different podium guests.
You can't do hypotheticals, though. You can't do that.
Hypothetical, because it's the same way. It's the same way we used to say on Lewis. Like, you take away Lewis.
Yeah, you can't do that.
It's not too bad, you know, afterwards. It's not too bad. But you know what the common thing is there? Red Bull's still dominating. Red Bull's still number one. Like, it's not a case of someone else is number two. Perez is still number one. The thing with Perez, I'll say, is, and people think it's harsh to say this, but realistically, he's underperforming. Because in Red Bull, okay, it's fine if Max wins, no problem. But you've got to finish two or three every race without fail. There's no like, oh, you know, I gave it a go. I finished fourth this time. Or I gave it a go. I was this close. But nah, you've got to finish two or three. And that's...
And I saw a spot that Lando has out-qualified him this year. Or does many drivers have out-qualified Perez this year as well?
You know what? I don't care too much for qualifying. Because at the end of the day, let's say, for example, even if you put... I'll be honest. If you put Max the back of the grid, he's still going to win the race. Because to start off with, the first thing you're going to know is the first six to seven drivers, will say, that's not our guy. Go ahead.
The first six, Abash, you know, it's probably the first 10. Or even... I'm not racing him.
You may get someone like Ricardo there or Hamilton just had a bad Q2 or whatever. So they're like, you know what, let's make it interesting. But for the first at least six or seven on the grid, they're going to be like, right, let him just get his spot. There's no point in us burning our tyres. There's no need for it. So to start off with, that's going to happen. If Perez is at the back of the grid, he's going to have to work through it because he doesn't have a fear factor about him. And then once he's through, it's like, okay, cool. Right, you're about 2 seconds behind eighth and you're sitting in 13th place. They're like, you can make this up in three laps. And then he's just going to go through the field. And that's because he's aggressive enough to do that, whereas others will probably be like, okay, he started 20th, he finished 6th, it's a good result, win driver of the day. Max is making sure he wins that race to become driver of the day, and nothing else will be good for him. Yeah.
And just obviously switching over to the team that are second in the constructors, because I've seen a lot of people talk about how they feel like the standards at Mercedes are kind of slipping, especially what happened after this race weekend, because first of all, Hamilton seems to be the only one in the mediums to start the race. And I always feel like if you're going to be at the back of the grid, whenever there's a race changing situation, when you've got nothing to lose, is the best time to gamble. And as you can see, not only did they gamble with Hamilton of leaving them out there when it was raining, they didn't even split the strategy and they left both of them out there, which seemingly cost both of them at the end. Obviously, Hamilton is still Hamilton, so he's going to get back up the grid. But to go from P13 to eventually P20 in a thing, whereas you can see when Perez, he took the opportunity, like Red Bull were on it, and you can see how many places he gained. Why couldn't Mercedes do something like that? Do you feel like as this is now going to be like another year in a row where Mercedes won't be in the title fight, they're letting the standards slip in terms of building the car strategy or whatnot? Or do you feel like people, again, are overreacting?
I don't think that is the case. I just think, do you know what it is? In terms of this hybrid era, Mercedes just haven't got it. They just haven't designed the car to succeed in this hybrid era. And Red Bull have. And that's why Red Bull dominated. Same way when Mercedes were dominating in that hybrid era, you know, Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren were ill-equipped to compete. And sometimes it goes in peaks and troughs. I think, you know, season three is where we might see, you know, Mercedes, okay, cool. We need to kind of figure out what we need to do and invest in it. I know they've brought some people back into the team, James Allison. And again, when you're a winning team, a lot of people go. So I've seen guys leave there. They've gone to Williams, they've gone to Red Bull, gone to Ferrari. So sometimes you're losing your best talent. You've got to build that infrastructure and ethos again within the team. Again, this season's a write-off for Mercedes. So after the next three races, they're probably going to start focusing on 2023-2024 season. Sorry, 2024 season. And I, look, it just is what it is. You go in peaks and troughs. We've seen Red Bull have had an era where they've won, you know, four with, what's it called, Vettel. They're probably going to win four with Verstappen, yeah? And we see Mercedes go and they've won eight. Lewis won his seven. Rosberg won his one. So if you look at it, they've had the same dominance, but Red Bull's had it in two stints, whereas Mercedes had it in one. And I just think once the new era comes in again, someone else is going to take the top notch. It might not be Mercedes, it could be McLaren, it could be Ferrari, but someone else will come and dominate. I just hope that next year Mercedes pull their pants up, pull their socks up, and then we can see the battle that everyone wants to see. Max with a great car, Lewis with a great car, let's see who wins. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But right about now, I'm not blaming them. I'm a Mercedes stan. I love Toto Wolff. I love Lewis. I love the team. So I'm not going to get at them. It's just, it just hasn't been a great 2 years or last 18 months, to be honest.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I'm sitting here as a Red Bull guy, just happy.
Of course.
Hey, listen, listen. Add more races to the calendar for Max to break more records.
Look, I hear you. I was the same guy. I was the same guy when Lewis was winning everything. Abbas was probably crying. He's probably had his head, his hands in his head.
I can't lie, you know. I won't cry, but I was very happy when it was that close between him and Vettel. And then, but I always knew that no matter what happened, because Mercedes just had that little bit extra, they were going to beat out Ferrari when Vettel was there. You always knew that. I think, like I said, for me, the two seasons that will probably stand out, and then outside of Vettel and the Alonso one and stuff like that, will probably obviously be Rosberg and Abe, because they did go at each other properly and it went down to the last race. You know what's funny about that race? Vettel knew what Lewis was doing and he didn't want to risk his German guy to mess it up for him and stuff like that. So even like you had guys that were not on even on the same team as Lewis be like, yo, no, this is our German guy. Like, we're going to help him. And Vettel helped Rosberg in that one to help him. But, yeah, like, when they made that call for Max, yeah, I can't lie. I was buzzing at that time. I was like, that was a big game changer, though, because from there onwards, it's just been plain sailing.
No, I said, it'll be interesting to see how things are. I do think the pack is getting closer. Maybe that might be because Red Bull don't really develop the car as much anymore and are focused on next year, but all we got to see competition, at least even if it's just what we got last season between Red Bull and Ferrari, it'll be better than what we've been given this year. But
don't put your hopes in Ferrari, man. Don't put your hopes in that team.
Nah, don't put your hopes in Ferrari, bro.
Like, let's have it with Mercedes instead, or even McLaren. Like, I'm done with them. Like, they're just a mess.
And the funny thing with Ferrari is always the same thing: reliability issues, pit stop issue. Like, it's always the same thing. It's like, you can't be having that same issues for the last 4 or 5 years. Like, maybe you need an overhaul of that whole team. Like, if when Formula One is good, you have a dominant Ferrari, the prancing horse. Like Ferrari is synonymous with Formula One. Like, if people know, like, the business of it, it's so crazy. Like, Ferrari do not do no advertising apart from Formula One. That's the only time they advertise their cars. They don't do no TVs on ad. They don't do no ads on TV. All they do is use Formula One to advertise. But you want to have a dominant, Ferrari. And that's why a lot of people are always thinking, if Ferrari can get their act together, would Lewis Hamilton go there? Because Lewis would want to be the guy that goes to Ferrari, brings them back, and then...
I'll be honest, if you win the championship for Ferrari, crazy. You're immortalized. Yeah, you're immortalized. That's why Vettel wanted that role so badly.
Bro, all of them wanted Alonso, Vettel, Massa, all of them. It doesn't get any better than that. So that's why a lot of Mercedes fans, when you hear, oh, Lewis ain't signed a contract, everyone thinks, he's waiting to see what Ferrari does. Because, like you said, at the moment, nobody wants him to beat Schumacher. But if he's in a Ferrari, everyone don't care if he beats Schumacher's record because he's bringing him back to dominance. So it's a win-win. Yeah. It's a win-win. It's a lose-lose. Lewis gets his ninth and then Ferrari get their championship. Who's going to complain? Like... It's set out for Lewis to win his ninth in the Ferrari.
I'll tell you who's complaining. Me, Christian, and Max. Like, we ain't letting this happen.
No. But bro, you know how this is, though. The dominant.
Yeah, 100%, bro. It'd be a mad thing. I think
you got to realize there's other teams coming in. Like, I think, is it 2025? I think Audi's coming in.
Yeah.
Audi's coming in with Porsche banner, and Porsche is going to spend a lot. They're going to be like Mercedes.
Porsche is mad. Like, Porsche with Le Mans and everything that. What they do stuff. Like, Porsche is a different thing.
Ferrari, and they're going to take people from Mercedes, Red Bull, Ferrari, Aston Martin. So, like, the field's going to get bigger, innit? So, let's just see. And you enjoy Formula One where it's a race. Not like, okay, cool, you watch it, you know who's going to win. That's why this season, like, as much as I love F1, I don't really watch it as much because I know nothing's going to change. Like, Verstappen's going to win. He's going to be, like, 20 seconds ahead of number two, which is his own car. And he's going to be whatever, half a second or whatever it is, half a minute ahead of whoever. So it's like, it's just boring. It's Groundhog Day. You know what's going to happen.
I can't lie. Ferrari did win. Like, I saw the Le Mans reaction. With Ferrari on F1, it'd be mad as well.
It'd be crazy. The Fozzy. You see Monza this weekend. It's going to be mad.
Yeah, it'd be mad.
Yep. I'm looking forward to that one as well. Looks like those guys have new suits and new liveries for the cars as well. But it looks like that's all we do have time for today. Thank you, Sam and Abbas, for... If I don't, I thank you guys because our platform. So, yeah, welcome back. As you can see, as usual, I'm going to put Sam and Abbas things below. And I've even just seen on TalkSport, Daniel Dubois is the 30-minute interview. Him talk about how he's being robbed. But, have some shame. But here's what it is. As I said, follow us on all platforms, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at outbounds_UK. And until next time, like, share, subscribe, and thank you for watching.